Welcome to In the Weeds with Nicole Asquith, exploring the way culture shapes our relationship to the natural world. Many of us in the West think of writing and the alphabet as one and the same, just like reading and our ABCs. But in fact, whereas writing was invented a number of times, in a number of places, the alphabet was only invented once. This event took place about 4,000 years ago when speakers of a Semitic language, probably in Egypt or the Sinai Peninsula, adapted elements of Egyptian hieroglyphics to represent the sounds of their language. And it is from this original alphabet that all of our modern alphabets, from the Latin alphabet we use for English to Cyrillic, Greek, Arabic, and Hebrew, are derived. One of the reasons I wanted to do an episode on the alphabet is that I've been rereading a book by David Abram that I've talked about a few times on the podcast. It's called The Spell of the Sensuous. In it, Abram argues that the invention of the alphabet opens what he calls a new distance between human culture and the rest of nature, as it turns our powers of perception inward and focuses our attention on human-made sounds and human-made words. Nowadays, when we're looking for something to blame for our alienation from the natural world, we're more likely to point the finger at video games or social media. But Abram looks further into the past, because he's trying to do a kind of historical philosophical diagnosis of the problem. The problem being this sense that humans have come to think of themselves as apart from the natural world. Now, to be clear, Abram isn't saying that writing is bad, and I myself am a big fan of writing, of books in particular, but I do find his line of thought intriguing. It's easy to worry about how social media is distorting our public discourse or about what video games are doing to our kids, and believe me, I worry about those things. But perhaps it's more revealing to think about how a technology that is much more fundamental to our lives, the alphabet, shapes our reality. In order to do this, we have to start by going back in time, by trying to understand how the alphabet came to be. Luckily, I found a willing guide in Johanna Drucker, distinguished professor and Breslauer professor in the Department of Information Studies at UCLA, and the author of numerous books, including, most recently, Inventing the Alphabet. Inventing the Alphabet is not a history of the alphabet per se, but rather a historiography of alphabet studies. In other words, an intellectual history of the way in which knowledge about the alphabet was transmitted and developed over time. It's fascinating. I recommend reading it. She's also internationally known for her work in the history of graphic design, typography, experimental poetry, art, and digital humanities. And she was kind enough to talk to me about the history of the alphabet. She not only gave me many interesting answers, but raised new questions and left me with a broader understanding of my own inquiry. There's a lot of information in our conversation. You may want to re-listen to certain sections. It's been a pleasure for me to re-listen to it as I prepare this episode. And I will put up links in the show notes and on the website to some of the places, people, and objects that come up in our discussion so that you can continue to learn more. The website, again, is in-the-weeds.net. Here we go. So I thought we would start by talking about the invention of the alphabet itself. It's such a fascinating topic, and I think something that a lot of people don't know about, in spite of how important the alphabet is in all of our lives. So you start out in your book with the observation that a lot of people may think that the alphabet, like other fundamental human inventions, might have been invented multiple times. We know that there are different alphabets, you know, the Greek alphabet, the Cyrillic alphabet, the Arabic alphabet, for instance. But in fact, it only happened once. So can you talk about that? Can you tell us the story, at least to the extent that we know it today?
Sure. And it's a great place to start. The misunderstandings about the alphabet are multiple and rampant. And as you said, people look at contemporary scripts like Cyrillic and Greek, Roman, and Armenian, and they think they couldn't possibly be related. But in fact, there's a single point of origin, and that's in the ancient Near East, where writing had been invented already for more than a millennium before the alphabet appears. And the alphabet appears as part of a cultural exchange between the Mesopotamian region to the north and east and North Africa, Egypt to the south and west. And both of those cultures had writing. The earliest writing systems we know of were the Sumerian pictographic scripts that are in that south part of the Mesopotamian Tigris-Euphrates River area. But, you know, the cuneiform scripts were the kind of lingua franca of the ancient Near East, but hieroglyphics also developed and then modified. And both of those scripts had capacities to represent ideas, words, as well as, to some extent, sounds. But the real breakthrough for the alphabet and the reason it's so efficient and the reason it works so well is that it really was sound-based. And sometime around 1800, 1700 BCE, Semitic speakers in the ancient Near East, and the Semitic languages are the major spoken languages in that region. All the languages in the ancient Levant were Afro-Asiatic, and the Semitic languages are the largest group. But Semitic speakers managed to analyze the sounds of their spoken language and figure out that they needed only about 18 signs to represent the significant features of speech. So that Proto-Canaanite taproot, which gets developed in that period, spreads all through the ancient Near East, down into the Arabian Peninsula, over into India and Southeast Asia, all around the Mediterranean and north and east into, you know, the Baltic states, Russia, all that area. And as the alphabet spreads, the script forms change. So Arabic doesn't look like Hebrew, but what we find is that the sequence of letters, Aleph, Aleph, Alpha are always the first letter, the names of the letters and the sounds attached to them remain more or less stable in spite of all the modifications. So these are important facts to know. Certain languages, Indo-European languages, for instance, such as Greek and Latin, required more explicit vowel notation than Semitic languages, which were largely consonant-based in terms of their orthography. So the Greeks added a number of letters to avoid ambiguity. So it's really from that single Proto-Canaanite taproot that we get all of the alphabetic scripts in use today. And aside from alphabetic scripts, the only scripts that are in widespread use are character-based, Chinese, Korean, and Japanese. But all of the other scripts, the alphabetic scripts in the world, derive from that single source. So that's in a nutshell, a kind of a big nutshell, but in a nutshell, that's the story.
Yeah. So my understanding is that although there were narratives for the origin of the alphabet that go way back, our recent knowledge comes from archaeological work, some of which is quite recent. There are two sites that I read about in particular that seemed especially important. One is Sarabit el-Qadim, and the other is Wadi el-Hol. So could you maybe talk about those places and what was discovered, why that was important?
Sure. Those are great sites and, again, revolutionized alphabet studies to some extent. We have to keep in mind that up until the 19th century, there was no archaeological evidence from that ancient Levant that was really, you know, directly related to the development of alphabetic script. Modern archaeology is a 19th century invention, and that region of the Levant had been occupied by the Ottoman Empire, so there hadn't been a lot of European research or European researchers in that area. So there were some, you know, cultural history issues, but it's just also that archaeology is a relatively modern science. And the inscriptions at Sarabit el-Qadim, which is where there were turquoise mines that used Semitic laborers, were discovered sometime, you know, at the beginning of the 20th century. And there's a beautiful little red sandstone sphinx that's in the British Museum that is inscribed with proto-alphabetic letters. And so that is one of the touchstone artifacts. And it's a beautiful thing, and the alphabetic script is recognizable, though it's still in a fairly emergent form. It looks more pictographic. And that's true with the Wadi el-Hol inscriptions as well. Now, Wadi al-Hol kind of tilted the entire alphabet studies world on its head because it is a site up the Nile at a particular kind of bend in the Nile. So it's actually on the African continent, whereas Serbet el-Kadim is in the Sinai. So the African continent, the Nile River, it's like, who was there? Why were Semitic speakers there? What were they doing? There's a bunch of historical analysis of this. But the Wadi al-Hol inscriptions were discovered by the Darnells in around 1990. And, you know, by their form, they look more primitive. They look earlier than the Serbet el-Kadim inscriptions. And it just was, you know, it's like, how did they get there? Who put them there? Were there literate people who were workers who were there, or were they local? You know, what was the culture? Who was speaking what language? So it raised all kinds of really interesting questions and still does.
So can you tell me a little bit more about who these Semitic speakers would have been? You know, where would they have been from? Do we have a sense of, you know, in the case of Serbet el-Kadim, we think that maybe they were people who worked in the turquoise mine. Would these have been elites? I mean, we have no evidence of the sort of eureka moment necessarily when the alphabet first came into being, but this sort of cross-cultural exchange between the Semitic speakers and the Egyptians that seems to have yielded the alphabet is just really interesting culturally. Can you tell me a little bit more about who these people may have been and what we do or don't know about them?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. And especially when we think about the development of writing in Mesopotamia and cuneiform writing, which is used for mathematics, it's used for astronomy, it's used for record keeping. In other words, it's part of a sophisticated urban culture. But the Semitic tribes were, you know, nomads. They didn't build monuments and they didn't leave a lot of large scale remains. So the inscription at Serbet el-Kadim is, you know, a hymn to Baal, the goddess. And so it's like pre-Jewish, as it were. So these are nomadic tribes, and they may have been mercenaries working, you know, just coming to work in the turquoise mines. There were mercenary Semitic soldiers who came into Egypt as well. So again, it's the question of what is the role of writing in that culture? Hymns make sense, right? Inscriptions that are kind of ephemeral. When we think about the earliest alphabetic inscriptions, for instance, in the Greek islands, a lot of them are little, you know, sort of Dimitri was here kind of things.
Like graffiti almost, right?
Yeah, like graffiti. Yeah. Yeah. And so they're, you know, they're not monumental inscriptions. That comes a lot later. And so that raises some interesting questions. It's like, if these are itinerant mercenaries, how do they know how to write? You know, how are they literate? And, you know, again, there's a lot of debate about this. There's a woman named Orly Goldwasser, who's a scholar, who really thinks that these were illiterates who adopted the concept of writing from seeing it around them and decided to start to write. Whether that's true or not is hard to say. But literacy itself depends upon, you know, an analytic understanding of the relationship between signs and sounds. And that's a pretty sophisticated thing to just leap to as an illiterate.
Right. Although at the same time, my understanding is that one of the things that's important about the alphabet is that you have a much smaller number of characters, right, than you have a pictographic writing system. And so in that sense, it's more accessible, perhaps.
Absolutely. And again, that's part of what makes it so efficient, so adaptable, and so powerful. Because look, we can use the same, what we call the Roman alphabet, what we use in, you know, in our common use. We can use it to transcribe languages that have no relationship to Indo-European languages, you know, just by doing phonetic transcription. Yeah, it's amazing.
It's so versatile. So, you know, I wrote to you that one of the things I was interested in talking about is the argument that the philosopher David Abram puts forth in his book, The Spell of the Sensuous, about the alphabet specifically. I went back and reread that portion of his book. I thought maybe we could use that as a way of working through the various steps in writing, not just, you know, how we get to the alphabet in the first place. I will preface this by saying that you know, overall, his argument, it's not an argument against writing, but he does argue that the invention of the alphabet, and for him, it's specifically when the alphabet becomes adopted by the Greeks and it no longer has any trace of a kind of pictorial connection, that makes humans, in a sense, less engaged in a central relationship with the natural world. But at the same time, he's interested in the connections between writing and the natural world in terms of how writing may have come about. So he starts with the actual signs that humans would have had to learn how to read in order to survive in the natural world. So he writes, for instance, about the tracks of deer, moose, and bear printed in the soil of the forest floor. And then when he talks about writing proper, he starts with pictographic systems of writing. And tell me if this is correct. The sense is that the earliest forms of writing started in a pictographic form where you had, for instance, a picture of a sun to represent a sun. So where there was a kind of one-to-one correlation. Is that right? If we go back kind of in the history, is that how the oldest forms of writing worked?
Well, yeah, yes. It's a kind of partial explanation because, well, pictorial signs are definitely part of Sumerian pictographs and Cretan pictographs and, you know, ancient Indus Valley scripts and other kind of proto-writing and early writing and underpinned cuneiform as well as hieroglyphics. The earliest writing systems that are record-keeping systems in the ancient Near East are actually what the scholar Denise Schmont-Besserat identified as tokens. And the tokens are used to impress a clay seal, and they're mainly used for counting. So that's also really interesting because you think about counting, you have a kind of tally system, you know, stroke, 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 but making the leap from a tally system to an abstract set of signs that can represent a quantity is an intellectual achievement. And then you start to have the concept of five represented. And many cultures have counting systems. So that's another aspect of writing, which is just the larger category of record keeping. And then almost all the writing systems that we know of did have pictorial origins and will represent the thing with a sign that looks like it. So you can look on ancient cuneiform tablets and you'll see a sign for beer and it looks like a cone with some foam. You know, it's like, oh yeah, it's beer. Exactly. So I'll take that, you know. So that makes sense.
Yeah, and, well, that's interesting about tokens. I mean, the record-keeping aspect of it and the counting, mm-hmm. I think, also speak to the kinds of, like, why the need for writing may have emerged in the first place, right? The kinds of civilizations that needed to keep track of things in a certain way.
Once we had hard grains and things that could be fermented and stored, oil, fermented beverages, and as I said, hard grains because you can't store soft grains because they mold, then you have the need for record keeping. You know, and one of the problems with these kinds of, you know, imaginings about writing coming from the hooves of deer or moose or bear, there were no moose, beer, mooses or bears in the ancient Near East. The Chinese have a myth that, you know, it's from the tracks of birds in the sand. And so these are kind of myths that exist about the invention of writing.
Yeah. I mean, to me, I mean, we can talk about this some more, but to me, what's interesting about Abrams' theory is not so much whether or not it's historically accurate, but more the way it is a starting point for thinking about the ways in which our technologies, I mean, we're talking about writing, but then, you know, eventually we can talk about more contemporary technologies, about how they mediate our relationship to the world. So it kind of like, something like the alphabet is something that we so much take for granted. But when you start to really think about it, think about, you know, where it came from and obviously the many ways in which it influences our own lives, you sort of build in this awareness of the ways in which it does very much shape and mediate our relationship to the world in a number of ways.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, you know, our capacity for abstraction and for representation of things that are not present to us is quite remarkable. And, you know, that is a human capacity that only a few higher primates and mammals approach, that capacity to represent the absent and the abstract within a sign system.
Right. And once you have a sign system, it can kind of sort of take on a life of its own. Can we talk a little bit about the rebus? Because that seems like an important stage in writing. People refer to it as a rebus or as a pictographic pun. So it's a way of using a representational form, but to represent a sound. Right. So the example that Abram gives is if you have a picture of bee and then a picture of a leaf, you could use that to signify the word belief. So when do we see those start to come into play?
Well, the hieroglyphic tradition is really the source for that in Western culture. And, you know, there's some wonderful, really wonderful scholarship that's been done on the myth of Egypt and its hieroglyphs, Eric Iverson's work and others, that look at the way, particularly in the Renaissance, but there are some earlier investigations of this, but in the Renaissance in particular, as Western Europeans began to rediscover the materials from antiquity, all kinds of ideas about how hieroglyphics worked informed scholars and artists who began to make emblem books and kind of pseudo hieroglyphics and so forth. And a lot of it's based on misunderstanding because we couldn't, as you know, read the hieroglyphs until the 19th century with the Rosetta Stone and decipherment. But there was some idea that these pictorial signs communicated directly to the eye and could be immediately translated into sound and so forth. Now, hieroglyphics do represent sounds, they represent ideas, and they represent words. And there's a category of determinatives that allows you to classify the set of signs you're looking at so that you would know that it was like a foodstuff substance, or it was a goddess, or it was a geographical site or something. So there's a fair amount of sophistication built into those systems early on.
Do you feel like there are things that these pictographic systems can do that our alphabet can't do now?
Well, you know, again, it depends on, I mean, one of the limits of pictographic signs is the range of interpretations that attach to them. So if you're using them literally, one-to-one relationship, as you mentioned before, between a sign and a thing, that appears to have a kind of stability to it. But think about a head, you know, what's a head represent? A mind, a person, a man, a woman, a decapitated person, you know, it's like the range of interpretations gets pretty broad. So within kind of the history of visual semiotics, there's mountains and mountains of ink that's been spilled on looking at the way in which the instability of visual signs introduces confusions, whereas textual signs have a greater degree of stability.
Yeah. It is striking to me when I see these images of the carvings of hieroglyphics, how fresh they still look, right? I mean, I guess it's an indication about the power of writing in general, right? To just have this longevity and to feel like it's speaking to you in the moment, you know?
Yeah. The skill of those carvers, it just completely boggles my mind. And of the cuneiform scribes as well, you this little cuneiform tablet that's about the size of a soda cracker, it's got, you know, line after line after line of very neat, swiftly done cuneiform. You just think, wow, right? it shows how literate the culture was, right? That there's that level of skill, training, and professionalism within the field.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
It really is incredible. Okay, so I'm just curious to get your responses to some of these arguments of Abram's. So for him, the important step is when there's no longer any kind of reference in the outside world, right? Because you start with, let's say, a picture of a sun representing the sun, and then you might go to the picture of the sun representing a sound, but there's still some kind of trace. And then in the early alphabet, those pictographic signs were used, but they were used just for sounds, right? That was one of the things that I found really striking learning about the history of the alphabet is that even in the letters that we use today, there are traces of hieroglyphics. Right?
Yes and no. So if you take a schematic form, right? Let me take two strokes and make them meet together at the top, right? Mm-hmm. And so is that a tent? You know, is that a fork? Is it a tool? Is it, you know, so schematic forms can provoke a lot of associations. And there's a principle called the acrophonic principle, which is that you take a word that begins with a letter, you know, Aleph, the ox, and you make a form that suggests an ox, and you attach those two things together. There's some pictographic traces in the earliest alphabetic scripts. You know, there's a figure with its hands raised. There's the kind of square for the house. There's the shape for the gate and so forth. But there's, you know, some debate about whether or not those kind of pictographic aspects of the letter forms actually came after the letters got their names, or whether the names come from the pictographs.
Oh, so for instance, in the Beth, which comes from the house, whether that came from the house or whether the house came after the creation of the letter. Interesting.
Because you want a mnemonic, you know, you want something that makes it easy to remember the name of it and remember the shape of it.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. Well, either way, at a certain point, we no longer have any connection to that, right? When we look at the letter A, we're not thinking of an ox.
Most of us are not.
Yeah.
Or a moose or a bear.
So for Abram, that happens, and I don't know if this is historically accurate or not, but for him, it happens with the Greek alphabet, because the Greeks allegedly got the alphabet from the Phoenicians. And they adopt it to their own language. And so if there is a trace of, you know, whether it's the ox or the snake or the house or whatever it is, it's no longer conscious, or it's no longer built into people's relationship to the letters in any way. So the letters represent the sounds, and they represent human sounds. And so in that sense, it becomes sort of self-reflexive.
But it's pretty true with, you know, the alphabet by the time it's being spread around the Mediterranean by the Phoenician traders.
That the alphabet is being adopted to new languages, and so...
It's already fully schematic.
Right.
You know, look at the inscription on the Ahiram sarcophagus, or, you know, any of these, you know, sort of right at the beginning of the first millennium, and even the things that go back on the Giza shards and Ostraca and so forth. So, you know, that schematicization is already happening, that degree of abstraction from the pictographic.
Right.
I mean, that's the form in which the Greeks receive the letter forms. So the Greeks don't do that. What they receive is already schematic.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. I think one of the reasons that Abram focuses on the Greeks in particular is that he's a philosopher, right? So he's writing in a philosophic tradition that goes back to Plato and to Socrates. And Plato is writing at a time when there is still an oral culture that is now being influenced and shaped and taken into different directions by a written culture. And so I think part of what fascinates him is the intersection of those two cultures and how they're perceived and how they shape Western philosophy as well.
Well, again, this is the standard line of classicists, and, you know, it also serves to erase the sophistication of culture in the ancient Near East and in the Far East and so forth. So, you know, the idea that there was no written culture before the Greeks, or that there wasn't myth, legend, poetry, and philosophy, astronomy, and the natural sciences before Aristotle, is just not true. Plato studied in Egypt.
Sure, sure. Yeah, well, I don't think that it's necessarily a Western-centric argument, in the sense that I think he is interested in that divergence, but also coming together of oral cultures and written cultures in other parts of the world as well. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, of course, it's easy in a way to make myths about what an oral culture was like, because, you know, by definition, we don't have a written record of it. You know, the most that we have is written records sort of taken from the outside, as it were. Right.
Yeah, the whole orality literacy discussion in the global sense is so interesting. And again, there's been wonderful work done looking at the differences between acquisition of writing in character-based cultures versus alphabetic cultures, other kinds of, sort of record-keeping and oral traditions. So I think it's a field where there's been really interesting, and fairly good skeptical work, sort of saying, to what extent do different forms of writing have different effects on cognitive development, capacities for reason, capacities for empirical or scientific thought, and so forth. So it's a really interesting area.
Yeah. The question of what happens when you have a new emergent technology and the way that it shapes our thinking and so on seems very relevant to our experience today.
Yep.
I'm of an age where I grew up without cell phones, without computers. And now I have children who are growing up completely immersed in a digital culture. And I feel like there are a lot of questions about how this is going to shape our thinking and our civilization more broadly going forward.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the capacity to pay attention in a sustained way seems to be something that is being transformed.
Yeah, for sure.
But you could say on another level, oh, look, these kids can multitask like nobody's business, right? They're on the phone, they're on their iPads, they're, doing this. It's just, but there's lots of people who study, again, the kind of cognitive impact of this. So it's an interesting field.
Yeah. I mean, my takeaway from that is that we just don't know, right? who am I to say, what long-term consequences this can have? I mean, I think that any significant shift like that causes anxiety, understandably, but ultimately it's impossible to predict. But I would like to talk to you a little bit because you work in media studies and this is a topic that's interested you as well. So going back to the alphabet, one of the things that you touch on in your book is what happens when the alphabet has to be digitized and transferred to computers and to the internet and so on. Can you talk a little bit about Unicode and what that is and how it works?
Sure. Unicode is very cool. And I will say that I must acknowledge the tutorial given to me by a grad student named Seth Erickson some years ago who helped me understand how Unicode works. Unicode is actually a place-based system that says, how many different discrete signs does any particular script need in order to be accurately represented? So if we think about, our standard keyboard and take a look at it, it's like, oh, we've got uppercase, lowercase, we have, periods, we have punctuation marks, we have numerals, and et cetera, et cetera. So how many, in a sense, how many seats do you need in the room to accommodate all of those things accurately and unambiguously? And then Unicode is simply a way to index a library of graphical signs. So if I say, I need 72 spots in order to disambiguate the upper and lowercase letters of the alphabet that is on my keyboard, then I can use Unicode to establish those discrete categories. And then I can index a whole library of graphical expressions. So it could be in italic, it could be in Roman, it could be in whatever. So it's a two-step process, which makes it really powerful again, because it means that a single Unicode standard for any particular script, whether it's, again, the Roman alphabet, Cyrillic alphabet, Hebrew alphabet, can also be used to call a huge number of different graphical expressions into play, depending on what's in the library. So it's very powerful in that way. And here again, there's really interesting discussions that are ongoing about whether or not Paleo Hebrew and Phoenician are different scripts or whether they are the same. Can they use the same Unicode standard? Do they have the same set of, elements, or are they distinct from each other?
It's one of the fascinating things about language is that it's always mutating, right?
Yeah.
Where a language begins and where it ends.
Well, this gets us into the emoji debate. I think your friend Mr. Aben would like very much, you know, because it's fun, it's visual, it's sensual.
Emoji debate whether that counts as language or
Yeah. You know, is it language? Is it, you know, pictograph? How stable is it? Yeah. I'm sort of a fan of emojis because I think they're kitsch and fun, but they, you know, they can be problematic. It's like, what does that mean?
<laughs> You know? Right. Problem of interpretation.
Yeah, purple devil cat, you know, is it a good thing or a bad thing? So
going back to Unicode, so why is that important? What does it get used for?
Well, if the alphabet undergirds the entire global communication system. So that's kind of amazing. You know, we can display characters on the screen and we can use characters for URLs now and so forth. But behind the scenes, all of the HTTP, the transfer protocols for data, are still in alphanumeric code. That's pretty powerful.
That is quite
powerful. I mean, think about, you know, yeah, that 4,000 years ago, this set of signs was invented in the ancient Near East and now is used for global communication. It's kind of cool, you know.
Quite amazing, yeah.
Yeah. But to go back to your point about new technologies for a second and their impacts, one of the things that's interesting to think about, I think, in terms of media and innovations are the ways in which the models that we grow up with shape our sense of what's possible. And, you know, the kind of famous example here is always the discussion that Friedrich Nietzsche, the philosopher, had of the school essay. He said, you know, the form of the school essay destroyed German philosophy because we all learned to write in this one particular form. And that was the form that informed, in the kind of active sense of, you know, giving form to, informed their way of making an argument, their way of thinking, and so forth. And when you think about writing and you think about letter forms, you think about layout on the page, you know, there's nothing in the technology of letterpress that prevents you from putting something at a diagonal or messing with the quadrature of it, except that it's cast to be able to be set up in good straight lines. But conceptually, you could mess with that. But we don't get anybody really messing with it until the 19th century. So why is that, right? It's not a technological limitation. It's a conceptual limitation. So that's also an interesting thing about media. It's like, how are we schooled in modes of expression by the media that we grow up with? And so I find that really interesting as well.
Yeah, it's interesting. Sometimes it seems like when there's an emergent technology, that's the moment when the possibility is the greatest in a way, maybe because things haven't been codified.
I mean, you may remember when hypertext first appeared.
Yeah.
And the, you know, people just went bonkers over it. It's like, this is going to transform all of our writing practices. Everything's going to be the garden of forking paths. We're going to have multiple narratives and blah, 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 blah. And it didn't really happen. You know, I mean, there was a kind of excitement. And in some sense, yeah, we all use links all the time now and hyperlinks and so forth. But for the most part, writing is still pretty much linear paragraphs and continuous argument.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe texting will change it to some degree.
Changing spelling.
Yeah, certainly changing spelling. Yeah, that's funny.
These things are so interesting. So to go back to something I think you were sort of, you know, hinting at before, it's like, when we get into abstract signs and schematic signs, a symbolic set like the alphabet, does that technology give us an arena that divorces us from other kinds of sense perception and relationship to the world? Or does it occupy a special niche within the culture and those other things go on? And, you know, it's, you know, I'm always struck in my morning jog by the fact that so many people are walking around with earbuds in and listening to something. And I just want to listen to the world. You know, I want to hear what's going on. And so if you're listening to packaged content and you're consuming programmatic information, is that a different sensual experience than the random sounds of birds, traffic, noise, whatever's going on? How do we continue to allow ourselves to access experience? What's the experience that we consider worth accessing? And does the alphabet as a symbolic system through its abstraction encode certain kinds of distances from the sensual world or not, right? So, you know, we live in the symbolic to a great extent as human creatures, but not entirely. We're embodied.
Yeah, that's, I mean, I think that Abram would agree with you in that respect. And he talks about writing also as a kind of animism itself, you know, as its own kind of magic.
Mm-hmm.
And the kind of magic that might have been practiced in relationship to the natural world is then transferred onto the page, you know, that it is a form of magic that we can look at these characters and hear words in our head.
Yeah.
And that also is a sensual experience. But whether or not that then cuts us off from the natural world, I think has to do with how we write and how we engage with it. But there definitely seems to be a risk with our technologies, and I think including the technology of writing itself, of having a kind of distancing, right? Just like we're struck by somebody walking around or running wearing their earbuds. But I think of, you know, I can relate to, I remember as a child relating to the scene in Jane Eyre where she closes herself off behind a curtain with a book because what's going on in the room mm-hmm. is just a little too much, you know?
Right.
And so there's definitely, even though books are a much older technology, there's definitely a way in which they can sort of seal us off or insulate us from what's going on around us, which is part of what we love about them too, right? It's not, these things are not necessarily, we don't have to say that they're good or bad. But I do think that it's an interesting question, especially as technology keeps evolving and it's sort of getting beyond us in a certain way. Like we don't know where we're going with all of it.
Right. I mean, you know, I think it's always nice to remember John Milton's wonderful words, right, about books, that books aren't dead things, and they have this kind of potency of life in them. They're active, they preserve the soul of whoever, you know, inscribed them, and that goes on across generations, geographies, and cultures. You know, that concept of the potency of life, the capacity of writing to call forth an experience after, you know, long spaces of time and distance is, you know, it's a wonderful thought. Yeah, letters have power.
Coming up, I'll be talking to anthropologist William Taylor about the domestication of horses and its impact on human history. I'll also have an episode on the spell of the sensuous, so we can actually delve into the book that I've been talking about so much in this episode. If you're feeling in the holiday spirit, please tell one of your friends, your family members about In the Weeds. I always love to have new listeners. Take care, we'll be back soon.